Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy, and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, this is the Southern Fork. Unscripted kitchen chats, and also studio chats, with some of the most interesting voices in the culinary South. I'm Stephanie Burt, a food and beverage writer based in Charleston, South Carolina, who travels with her fork to write for a variety of publications, from magazines you might have on your coffee table to the website you love to visit for your favorite recipes. And I'm inviting you to come behind the scenes with me to get to know the people who make this Southern culinary landscape so special. I'm always hungry for the next bite, thirsty for that next sip, and ready for the next conversation. Let's dig in. The Southern Fork is sponsored by Smithy Ironware. As the temps drop and hanging out by the campfire or the fire pit or the tailgate sounds like just the thing, don't forget how versatile this cast iron is for outside cooking. From cornbread in the oven to steaks on the grill to your favorite tailgate wings, Smithy skillets are designed to perform wherever the location or whatever the cooking occasion. Over the years, I've worked with Smithy to collect recipes from some of the best chefs in the biz, many of whom have taught me that cooking with Smithy on a grill or over a fire is one of the best ways to use it well, as their tagline goes. So it's the perfect time of year to invest in a Smithy. You can find all Smithy sizes and there's recipes too at smithy.com. That's smithey.com. I use my Smithy well all the time, and I can't imagine my kitchen or my grill without it. Now, there's much more to seafood than do you want that batter fried, broiled, or blackened? Ready to explore it with me? After this interview, I looked up if I'd written that The Ordinary, one of Chef Mike Latta's restaurants in Charleston, South Carolina, was a, quote, temple of seafood. I had, but so had T Magazine of the New York Times years before. I don't think I read that article, but it just goes to show how something seeps into a culture nevertheless. The same goes for Latta's approach to local seafood. What he does here in Charleston influences chefs across the region, and his focus on sustainably caught, perfectly fresh seafood has helped elevate the culinary conversation, even if he's not the only one focusing on fresh, local, and seasonal. We dive into what inspires him about that fresh caught food, and we also get a glimpse of the drive, focus, and crafted talent that has made him one of the most recognizable chefs in the South. Welcome to the Southern Fork, Mike Latta.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, today here is in the Ulm Radio Studio, and we are sitting inside the workshop. So behind us, the workshop is going to be filled with coming in for early lunch while we are chatting, but that sound might kick up a little bit. There's 1980s music playing out there, too. But thanks for coming when you have... I don't know. Do you spend time in Charleston anymore? I feel like I'm always seeing you travel.
I'm here all the time, really. At times of the year, the travel gets a little rough, like this time of year.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were just in Oxford for the Southern Foodways Alliance Symposium, and then prior to that, I had a couple of events that were just kind of overnight events. But honestly, the best times of the year are the summertime.
Yeah.
Because we don't have a lot of events, and... even though it's hot and muggy, it's the best time for us to be in Charleston because we can relax and enjoy our city and have routine and
go to the beach,
do something specific on every Wednesday night, or go to the beach on Sunday mornings, which I crave.
Yeah, yeah. It's still beach weather.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, it's the secret time of year when we can go to the beach after Labor Day and still enjoy it. But I really want to focus today on seafood because I really think of you as a master of seafood. I know that you cook vegetables really well as well and other proteins, but I think you've really made your mark professionally with seafood and specifically with something that some people call bycatch, some people call trash fish. And I don't like the term trash fish. Do you?
No, I can't stand it. But you know, FIG was back in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, you know, there was no conversation about vegetables.
Right.
And so what we thought would be important would be to start that conversation, you know, in Charleston. Mm-hmm. First in Atlanta for me and then Charleston. And it was, where are the growers? How are we connected to them in the restaurants? How can we buy directly from them and put those, you know, put the produce on the menu seasonally? And tell a story of where we live through the things that are growing currently. So market-driven cuisine, farm to table, call you what it will, but that was the idea back then and has always been kind of my stamp.
Right.
But what happened was, well, first of all, everybody kind of came up to speed.
Mm-hmm. Which
so
is cool.
So there wasn't that much to talk about anymore because all of our peers were shopping and cooking the same way. That's the greatest thing about the Charleston market, is that once something kind of catches on and makes sense, everybody's like, well, I mean, let's just all do this. And it all makes sense.
And you talk for all to of each us. Other.
Well, you know,
and
at
you
first,
watch each other.
At first, when we were, let's say, a great example. So Celeste Albers is like the matriarch, right, of the of connecting, I think, farms to Charleston restaurants. And back when she first started growing produce, she's the one that lured me to Charleston from Atlanta. So seeing the work she was doing in the field was, I was like, wow, I have somebody here that I can really do something meaningful with. And then,
and we talked about that. I've had her on the show. And I said, how does it feel to be the person that inspired FIG?
And so she can definitely take credit for bringing me to Charleston and the creation of FIG, for sure. And then, you know, after this became a pretty noteworthy experience. So we would quite often be in the paper talking about our market-driven cuisine at FIG and what that meant. And however, we became kind of maybe the de facto restaurant to mentor and bring in growers. So growers would come to our back door all the time, like the Kennedys, Dan Kennedy, and then you know, Jay and Billy from Blackbird were doing some work locally, and so was Ambrose was involved, and all of a sudden we had a little network. And then you had people like Rita, right, from Rita's Roots,
right,
who was inspired to do the same thing,
and Keegan, so
we worked a lot with them, Keegan Fillion Farms. So anyway, my point of the story is that, like, and we would share, all the chefs would say, well, if we want this person to be successful, like take Rita, for example, which was an upstart. Most of the ones you mentioned had already been growing.
Right.
We would say, okay, who are the chefs in town that I can recommend work with Rita that are patient, understanding, understand the value of a partnership between a producer and a chef, as opposed to what was once maybe chefs were kind of ruling with an iron fist, or they're demanding the carrots be all the same way and having unrealistic expectations for what a grower could really do. So those guys were and gals were better suited for Chef's Garden or something like that. Long story, a little bit longer, while at FIG, and this was kind of our whole beacon, and this is everything that we were doing, and all of our systems for the menu that exists today, Mandate the Ordinary ultimately, were created of how do we receive all the information from all the growers almost and simultaneously get that food onto the menu in a creative way that is expressive as a chef and restaurant. While this was all happening, we were serving, if we did 200 and something, say we did 200 covers at night or sold 200 entrees, 170 of them would be seafood. And we were so focused on produce, and I think a lot of chefs were focused on pork at this time as
Right.
And, which was awesome. And Craig Deal did some amazing work, but everybody started doing charcuterie. And as a chef owner, I couldn't really see the investment in both. We didn't have the space at FIG.
Right.
But so seafood started making a lot of sense to me. And this was before, you know, pre-Mark Marhefka, which is a game changer for us, certainly, and for everybody.
Absolutely.
And we were buying from like Kimberly's, from Owl Seafood, and we were buying shrimp from Magwood at times. But the demand for great seafood and the lack of attention it had been getting in the city, and my love for the fact that, you know, at Fig, you know, there was a time we were so dedicated and still are to local proteins. We really were limited to pork, chicken. Beef has never been a big thing for us. We've always had some kind of beef. Now we're buying from Brasstown in Asheville area, which is a great product.
Great outfit,
it was like,
yeah,
you know, they're awesome. But we were like, well, there's, you know, a dozen different kinds of snappers and groupers, and they all cook differently and look differently.
And of course, you have the local shrimp.
We had the local shrimp, clams, you know, oysters weren't yet. So Clamor Dave, I think it came to me maybe in 07.
Right.
You know, I started to recognize the fact that maybe there needed to be a little more attention towards seafood, supporting the fleets, and, you know, dedicating, you know, ultimately, which became the restaurant, the Ordinary, which became a temple of our local of purveyors that we had curated over the years of relationships.
I think I wrote that down. I think that's my line.
Is that your line?
That's my line. Thank you.
Well, did you say it was extraordinary?
I don't think anybody can say that.
But that was our kind of our...
I said temple of seafood.
Yeah, I saw that my homework last night. when we were creating... You know, so we just realized, you know, cooking seafood is so incredibly stimulating. And, you know, at this point, I dedicated most of my career to really learning how to butcher and fabricate all the animals I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. Even we were getting in some quarter sides of steer from Celeste and wrestling with those at times. But seafood just fit. It fit everything about us. It was like, it was wild, right? It's the only wild food that we really eat, you know, except for the, you know, occasional mushroom and ramp every once in a while. And it connects us to the place that we call home, you know, and it's extremely expressive what we produce here locally. And I think there just wasn't a ton of attention. Obviously, when people would come into town, and that would be the number one question you would hear is, where can I get it? Where can I get the best seafood?
I still get that a ton.
Yeah. Right. So we strive to answer that every single day. And it's a very, well, certainly there's plenty of competition now. My growing love for seafood started at Fig and realizing the demand for it. And then as I progressed as a craftsman, you know, the so many different techniques that you can use to make fish delicious just is the biggest palette you could imagine creatively. And so, and I don't know if I can articulate this or not, but with chicken or beef or pork, you know, there's like searing. Of course, you can poach and you can sous vide, and there's lots of different things you can do. You can fabricate it and stuff it with farce and do all kinds of things. But with seafood, it's so delicate that when you start to just to touch it, you become informed about what you might want to do with it. So not every fish we buy, even from Mark, is worthy of crudo. Sometimes we don't intend to serve a fish that way, but then we open it up and we go, oh my gosh, this is, you know, what one of our purveyors from Low Country Lobster calls diamonds, which is just a great way to say it's a diamond because there's a lot of A-pluses out there, but there's not a ton of diamonds.
Right, right.
And so we'll have these diamonds and we'll... and be inspired to do something maybe that we hadn't planned on doing. And so being connected to the butchering process for every single fish is a very important role for the seafood chef because they, and even the different shapes and sizes create different cuts. Like if you get a 5 or 6 pound flounder, you can actually serve like flounder chops or with big wahoos or small wahoos, you can cut steaks in the round. You can do all kinds of different things.
And it just took you spending time with the product in the kitchen. And,
correct.
And I think a lot of chefs, they're running. You know, they're running. They have to get those numbers. Something has to come in the door. And they're not carving out time, to use a pun, but carving out time to really spend time with the product.
Paramount. It's so important. And as we've gotten bigger, right? You know, we all know Jason at Fig is you know, a complete chef at this point in his life. He does amazing stuff. And we work side by side. And as I've trained now a couple of chefs at The Ordinary, it's like I say, well, you know, you've signed up for a very intense position. Not only do you have to manage the people, which is the job, then you've got to manage.
You have to manage yourself.
The food. Well, that usually comes last until you hit 30, 35 years old.
Right.
Maybe 40. And then you have to be able to be find a way to stay completely connected to the product that's coming in the door, because it informs everything. It really does. And if you have a menu like we do, which is maybe a little too big at the moment, once you receive that fish and you start breaking it down, all of a sudden you realize it's got six avenues, right? We've got a chowder dish that catches like the smallest scrap of the fish, or like the cheeks that we pull out or carve out the collars or something mm-hmm. like that mm-hmm. for whatever scrap we can get off the carcass goes into the chowder. And then we have like more hearty entree type stews where as we're portioning the fillets and we're squaring them up or mm-hmm. something like that, if you will.
It's nice trim.
It's really nice trim. So that goes into like more mm-hmm. of a proper stew type mm-hmm. format. And then we take the heads and we boil them and we pull the meat and we make like a little tête de poisson, which is a little fish head cake really. But you wouldn't be able to do any of these things or really manage the inventory in the menu with what we attempt to be perfect seafood all the time if you don't see it and feel it, touch it, and talk to the fishermen and understand so many things about it. So mm-hmm. it's and that, and I guess what I'm in a roundabout way trying to get to is that it's very stimulating mm-hmm. and very rewarding when you can do it well. But it's a really difficult thing to do.
And I remember when tile fish was exotic in Charleston, when you would get a tile fish sandwich, and now I'll be walking down East Bay and look at the chalkboards and I'll see tile fish on there. And I think, thanks, Lotta, because that comes on the menu, and that hashtag that we talk a lot about in the industry, chefs lead, and really you can push ideas on the plate. You know, tile fish is not exotic in Charleston anymore.
No, not at all. You know, this could be repetitive, but the two things that I'm the most proud of that way is I came down from Martha's Vineyard mm-hmm. by way of Atlanta. And we had, maybe back then the rules weren't the same. Maybe they were breaking the rules, but the restaurant where I worked, there was fishermen that came to the back door quite often, and it seemed acceptable at the time, which is not acceptable now, except unless you're like Mark and licensed to do both catch and wholesale. And we would see all kinds of fish that people just wouldn't really want to eat. Bluefish is an easy one, but go back mm-hmm. to the 90s. Bluefish was not, before the term trash fish was a household term. That was trash fish, right? Mm-hmm, so bluefish mm-hmm. was not a big
right.
thing. And you couldn't get it off the coast because it was so perishable. I finally got here when I was heading up Anson. I had asked the guys at Crosby Seafood, I said, what do you like that you can't sell or people just don't want? Mm-hmm. And they go, there's a fish called triggerfish that we just can't move. But it's delicious. It eats crustaceans and crabs, and the meat's tender and sweet and firm. And I said, well, send me some. Mm-hmm. And
that sounds a little bit like sheep's head, which is
exactly
really delicious.
But triggerfish wasn't anywhere.
Right.
I would say, when I always say that, there's a little asterisk that I would say that Frankly probably served it
right.
because Frankly was way ahead of all of us.
Frankly
anyway.
Is Frankly still to this day. Yes.
But we started selling it at Anson and we educated the staff about it. Next thing you know, this fish was just like our biggest seller, hands down. And a great value, right, for us mm-hmm. as a restaurant mm-hmm. and for making food costs. And we passed off a decent amount of that value to the guest. But it seemed like, I don't want to take credit for it, but man, I really felt like I was like, wow, we have a lot of power as chefs to make a impact here.
Yes.
And I was new to town and there wasn't a lot of restaurants, so maybe we were getting a lot of attention. And but soon after that, I feel like triggerfish, I mean, it was maybe a 7 or 8 or 10 years later, mm-hmm. There were catch limits on it mm-hmm. where there hadn't been before, if I understand right. it correctly, which I thought was kind of interesting. And then
it's now listed on that wholesale sheet.
Oh, it's like
versus,
I would think,
you know what I mean?
It's almost as closely tied to our seafood culture and cuisine as any fish on the market
I
right
agree.
Now. And
mm-hmm.
because I think it's we can sell almost all that's caught, in our area. Mm-hmm. It seems when I go to New York or Boston or anywhere, I rarely see triggerfish on the menus. So that, and then when in 2008 or so, when all things were getting weird, maybe it was a little bit later than that, maybe The Ordinary was already open. So at any point in time, there was a big moratorium on grouper and snapper. Mark
right.
Marhafka was like, mm-hmm. man, what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And we said, okay, well, let's just think of everything. Why don't you catch whatever you catch, don't throw it back. Mm-hmm. And just bring me buckets and tubs of stuff, and mm-hmm. we'll just cook it. We'll drop it in stock or poach it, or we'll roast it or fry it or whatever. We'll see if we can find something that you can target while you can't catch the fish that you're actually built to catch, your boat's built to catch. While you can't catch that, maybe you can find something else. And that's when he gives me a rudder fish one day. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, there's a lot of stuff in this pile. A lot of it is a lot of work. But this rudder fish is really cool, and it's really delicious, and it's like a little jack. And he says, mm-hmm. well, I think it's a... don't quote me on this, but he said, I think it's the same species as a hamachi, which is a big farm-raised fish that you see all over the place on menus that don't change like ours do. It's a great right. fish to get from, I think most of it comes from Hawaii, but it's a farm-raised fish that's really kind of solid, even mm-hmm. if it's, you know, I'm not a huge farm-raised fish guy, but, and long story short, it's a, he said it was a wild hamachi, and it cuts beautifully. It eats in all kinds of ways, but it's a little perishable, not mm-hmm. crazy, like bluefish. Mm-hmm. But soon after that, Mark started pushing it. Of course, he now has accounts around town. He says, you know, this is a fish that we think is pretty solid. So everybody in Charleston starts picking it up. And this was almost overnight. Mm-hmm. And then I remember getting a cut list from either Inland Seafood or Halpern's, one of the, you know, bigger wholesalers mm-hmm. that we buy mm-hmm. from.
Inland's based in Charlotte, but has a lot of...
Yeah, I think it's yeah. Atlanta. Mm-hmm. They may have an outpost in Charlotte.
Yes, yes, you're right. You're right.
And then Halpern's at one point was based in Atlanta, and right. I think still are, but they, you know, they work with docks all right. up and down the eastern right, seaboard. Right. But I looked at their cut sheet one day, and I saw rudderfish was on middleman's cut sheet.
Right,
and I was
right.
like, wow, that took no time at all. And
yeah.
I'm sure it wasn't there before. So yes, you can influence a lot of people with your purchasing, and but really, when it comes down to it, of course, you have to make it taste good, but the servers are the ones that do most of the work.
And
right?
it is an education thing. So I've been wanting to ask you this question for a long time, and I'm going to ask it on the air. I hear from chefs all the time in smaller markets that say, well, gosh, I'd love to cook that X, Y, or Z, or people just don't go for my food, or they want this. And so there is a line when you're cooking creatively, but also cooking commercially, that you have to lead a palate instead of just respond to a culture's palate.
Right.
And that is a combination of factors, of course, servers and your wait staff included in education. But if you got that question from a chef, what is your answer?
That's an awesome question. So one of the benefits to being a chef operator, owner operator with my business partner, Adam, is that we can make decisions however we see fit, right? So if I decide that I want to run rudderfish, I don't have to pass it by an owner mm-hmm. that might say, my customers don't like rudderfish. Mm-hmm. And just think about
or
that.
Or even worse, I don't like rudderfish.
Right, right. I'm not sure which is worse, but they're both pretty bad. But then you've got this culture that the customer knows what they want. Well, they only know what they've been exposed to.
Yes.
And with our ability to, well, listen, first of all, maybe I wouldn't have had the confidence, but when we first opened Fig, it was so radically different from most of the restaurants in town. I think people automatically, and listen, it you wouldn't, if you looked at our first menu, you would say it's not radical at all, but there was something about the restaurant where people just said, I'll eat anything. So I don't know if you remember or not, but we had one of our best sellers was sweetbreads.
Yes, I do.
We were serving dozens of entree portion sweetbreads
yes.
at night. And then rabbit, which is always the one that you think should sell but doesn't, and nobody likes it. Mm-hmm. And it's tough to cook well.
I eat that about twice a year.
Rabbit?
It's just not one that I would order, that and pork chops. But if somebody hands it to me, I'm going to eat it.
Right.
I'm going to try it. Right.
So Fig always had this, we always had the confidence that we could, and at one point, maybe a year after we opened, I was like, Adam, I think I can serve whatever I want here. Like, I don't think people care. Mm-hmm. But dissecting that, maybe there was that connection that I had to, that freedom, that free will that I had to do whatever I wanted, that of course that I thought made sense. But then I could walk directly from the kitchen to the table and support it. And we also, and hats off to my partner who over the years has been doing this so beautifully, he would listened to what we were doing in the kitchen, and he would make it his mission to make sure that the service staff would represent it well on the floor. So we had a culture with our service staff right from the get-go that would be very connected to the product. So when they were talking about it, they were impassioned, and they were talking with their tables, and they could easily sell them anything because they were like, listen, we've got this amazing new fish from a fisherman that only sells directly to restaurants. And he called in the order with Mike on the sat phone, and it came in this morning, and here it is for you. Just so happens it's called rudderfish or triggerfish or whatever. And people would be like, yeah, I'll try it. And you know, I think if you run a consistent restaurant, if people don't feel like they've got to order the same thing all the time because they don't want to have a dud, then I think you're also running uphill a little bit. So you've got to make sure, like, I think one of our benefits has always been my number one philosophy has been like, we have to be consistently delicious first. Creative falls somewhere in second, third, or fourth, but the brass tacks of making people happy don't start with my ego. Starts with our ability to make food good consistently. And I think if people think that they can go anywhere on the menu and have a good time, then I think that they're more apt to try something different.
It's more relaxing.
Yeah.
Like when I go to Fig, I never look at the menu ahead of time. I never say, this is what I'm going to get tonight. I just sit down and go, whatever. Anything's going to be good.
Right. So what I say, my least favorite question is, what should I have? I'm like, well, I don't know you.
Right.
I don't know what you like and don't like.
That's usually what I say,
like,
too.
I said, I would encourage you just to put the menu down and totally just close your eyes and put your finger on the paper twice and tell the server what it is or let them figure it out and then just put them away and like enjoy your company.
Right.
Because really, you know, on any given day or any like, depending on your proclivities, like I can't recommend it for you.
Right.
But I'm confident that we've combed over everything on the menu every day to give you an equally good experience all the way across the board and get a gnocchi.
Get a gnocchi.
Just because it makes people so happy.
I know. I just miss the egg. I always miss the egg.
Well, bring that up with Jason.
I know. I have multiple times, but off air. At the ordinary, the sleeper hit for me right now, not often enough, is the vegetable carpaccio.
Oh, the zucchini.
Because I look at it and I think, this is just sliced zucchini. Steph, you know what zucchini is. And I taste it and I go, there is so much going on here and the little herbs and just everything about it. It's so delicious and I don't expect it, even though I've had it. Every time I get it, I'm like, it's not going to be this good. And it is.
I don't know how it tastes so fresh.
It is. It's so fresh and full with and it's raw zucchini. I just feel like zucchini is best in zucchini bread. You know, like, it's just not. It's the deft hand, the difference. But
well, when you open a seafood restaurant where everything is very expensive. Like you think oysters, right? I mean, we hear it all the time and it's still, I have a hard time hearing it. Even knowing all the details that I know about what it takes to put on a restaurant like that. People claimed it to be expensive when I assure them that our $37 entree of a good 6 ounce piece of fish is probably worth every bit of all the other, like, I mean, you go to what used to be the Anchor Line on Folly Beach or like those seafood entrees are $35. But oysters, they cost $1.50 a piece,
right.
And we lose about 10% on a good product, and things get pretty pricey. So we had to come up with an idea to attack the food cost, and it's like a pretty easy formula, one that I would teach in culinary school if you're trying to manage your food cost. It's like, well, take the top 5 or 10 movers and really examine what you have into each plate and what you're charging. But you got to find something that people love that you can produce cheaply and let the craftsmanship be the value as opposed to the product, because there's about a nickel worth of zucchini on that plate.
Right.
But it takes the cook, you know, a long time to make that plate taste and look good.
It is extremely composed and extremely beautiful.
And it's a good deal. I mean, it's a plate of beautiful food for, I don't know, $11 or something like that.
Right. It's really, really great. Would you consider yourself a tactician? That is what Jeffrey of Red Clay calls you.
So finding your voice and who you are and what you do is a lifelong journey, and it changes along the way. But what I always come back to is there's a whole breadth of chefs out there right now that have more information than I ever had, have more inputs than I ever had. And there's just more restaurants and more chefs. And there's a whole culture now of, let me compress the world on my menu. And, you know, my old schoolish self is like, well, man, you guys got to find a focus. You know, like that's the way a business is really going to work, is if people really, if you have a real identifiable formula, be it, you know, technical or creative or whatever. And it seems like a lot of the, and at first I was like, man, these guys are never going to, you know, the chefs that really seem to be drawing from every culture, how can they possibly make a living doing this for very long? And I've been proven wrong. It's like, it's just the things have changed.
Right.
So, and like, and I'm still an active chef. So I was like, how do I change with it? You know, you keep turning inward. And I always come back to the fact that, you know, my first love for cooking came from the taste, right? It came from the taste of the food that I was eating, which may, well, I guess that most people would say that, but that's where I go when I'm cooking. It's like, I wanted the person in the sitting in the seat to have something that tastes delicious. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to go, well, that's neat. It's pretty good. I want them to say, God damn, that's delicious. And so that, if you think about how you make decisions from there down, I literally picture myself in the seat, part of my creative process. And I think about what people like and how I can give them something they don't know they like, but it's still framed in familiarity. But then my goal, which I don't always succeed in doing, is to make it, to craft it beautifully. And to consider the freshness, the ripeness, the age of the vegetable, or when I say age, the maturity level of the vegetable. Like, not all kale is built for salads. And how do I like make all those decisions based on every single thing we have in our restaurant to like whittle down each dish to be delicious? If you think about all the work that goes into doing that. So it's the relationships with the growers, being there to receive the product, being there to coach the team through processing the product, however it's done, separating or grading the product and say, this is good for this and this is not good for that. And then creating a menu around those things with some level of cohesiveness, then to, and we do this every day, and then, you know, training the staff on how this new dish is going to work with the slightly different vegetable that we have in today, to then as a customer saying, every time I go to this restaurant, it's always delicious. It's like, wow, well, where do we leave time to like innovate? We don't. And so that's not my thing. And however, I feel like I've created quite a few staples and signatures in my life that are unique to me, and I'm very proud of them. So my place in the field is, like I always say, singer, songwriter, folk artist kind of person that like really writes the songs or cooks the dishes that make you feel the way you want to feel.
I don't really think about you with an acoustic guitar, but
you don't.
Interesting. Oh, yeah. No, that's a very interesting analogy.
I performed a little bit.
Oh, very interesting. Well, okay. You have a temple of seafood. You have Fig.
It's going to be 17.
17.
In April, yeah.
Okay. You have a pretty robust, I don't know what it would be called, consulting kind of thing. Like, you've done Kiwa, you've done the Garden and Gun Club in Atlanta. What makes you hungry now?
Well, creatively, if there was just a deep pool of people that loved cooking in restaurants, I'm sure we'd have more restaurants. And that's why the consulting thing has been attractive. It's like, how can we expand? How can we challenge ourselves creatively with new things without taking on the whole risk? And consulting has been kind of fun that way. The Garden and Gun project looked a little bit different than the Kiowa project. It was kind of like, get us open and we're done. Or Kiowa's, I've got a 5-year ongoing contract with them. And so I accepted both of those, one with Adam and one without. The Kiowa one I'm doing on my own, just to see what I could do. And that was a really exciting year of my life to build the concept that we executed out there, as well as the Garden and Gun one was our first toe in the water of taking a concept. They said, here's our brand. Help us make a restaurant. That was kind of cool.
Yeah. And it's the brand.
It's the brand. Yeah, yes. I know. And that was the...
You walk in and you're like, this is kind of like Garden and Gun.
I know. We were proud of that. We are proud of that place. So now, what? And I know there's a couple more questions that may tie into this. What makes me hungry now is there's so many things, right? So I don't want to stop learning. And That simple statement means that I have to prioritize actual, you know, the actual work it takes to get better, which yes. is not the same as maintaining, right? Mm-hmm. Maintaining is well, it's hard enough, actually.
It's calibrating craft
right.
instead of just repeating.
And if you think about, like, the exit strategy for a chef my age, I'm 47. I'm nowhere near being able to stop anytime soon. And if my career is 20, let's just say it started at Fig, right? Which it didn't, but let's say it did 17 years ago. Well, it's conceivable that I'll be cooking in 12, 15 years from now. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of like halfway. And after the dust settled from opening The Ordinary and kind of like, which has taken years for me to kind of get my head around getting out of Fig and detaching a little bit from Fig and focusing on a different restaurant has been a struggle for me. But I just kind of woke up not long ago saying, I have got to make sure that I am in it still, because I don't want to, A, rest on my laurels, but I don't want to stop getting better. Mm-hmm. And so that hunger, to answer your question, is I still think I have a lot more in the tank. Mm-hmm. And I think it could even be the best part.
Excellent. So is one aspect of your personality really showcased by an aspect of your job, besides your love of, apparently, your love of spreadsheets?
Oh, yeah. So I think the culture of our kitchens mm-hmm. would best answer that question, because they're so unique. And they're not comparable to anybody, and I've stopped doing that a long time ago. Certainly, we borrow discipline from, like, because of my age, I'm sure, Thomas Keller's first book and how that was a de facto, you know, guide for us on how to cook with technique. And, mm-hmm. But the way that we breathe through the seasons, Jason and I spent the weekend traveling together and talked about that same thing that we've been talking about for so long. It's like, what we do is so high maintenance, but it's such a religious, well, it's in our DNA now, right? Couldn't think of doing it any other way. So that really is like, we have to get up in the morning and make the phone calls to see what's coming in. We have mm-hmm. to be a day or two ahead all the time. Both mm-hmm. restaurants have very small storage areas, so we can't, you know, buy a week's worth of anything ever. Mm-hmm. So we have to constantly maintain those menus. And I think how that translates to my personality is like, I want to be pleasantly satisfied. Mm-hmm. But it's never good enough. Mm-hmm. I work on the pleasantly satisfied thing all the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think fear of failure still lives in me strong. So, mm-hmm. you know, by pushing to be the best version of ourselves and evolving, mm-hmm. Is what really I think is how my personality shakes out.
What keeps you up at night?
All kinds of stuff. And I'm a notoriously terrible sleeper, and it's not because I worry as much, but I definitely think I open my eyes all the time at around 4 o'clock in the morning.
Mine is 3:15.
And
I've got ideas.
There's a window. Mm-hmm. If I can't shut it down quickly,
yes.
It's getting too close to 6 a.m. to turn. This happened last night.
Exactly.
And what I thought about last night is the same thing I think about all the time, is like, how do I make the day that I'm about to have, like, how do I get all of I can, how can I wring it out and get everything I can out of it? Mm-hmm. And so I start thinking about, well, and I try to work out 4 or 5 days a week. And, you know, if I get up now, make my son breakfast and get him off to school, then I'll be done at 7:45, hit the gym at 8. By 9:15, I'm on my way home. And I just kind of like started like setting up my day. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the things that I worry about that might more answer that question are just like, will it ever get easier? Mm-hmm. Because it's demanding. And I love it. So it's okay for me, but I worry about so everybody talks about the younger generations wanting to work a little bit differently and less, and there's studies about it. And like, you know, people want to have more time, less money, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. But listen, I mean, there's got to be plenty of people out there that are built for kitchens, mm-hmm. built for the life. It's good to so many of us. Mm-hmm. I just want to surround myself with more of those people, because you know, if it continues to, the demands for new restaurants open because they're lucrative investments in a time of, you know, that the economy's flourishing, yeah, people can open them up, but we just don't have enough people to support all of them.
Right.
You know, when I first moved to town 22 years ago, you had, you know, if you were like, I'm going to be a culinarian, going to be a chef. You had four choices, maybe. Right. Five. I mean, not right. to, there was more choices, obviously, but I think that if based on the media, you know, there was not that many options.
In this conversation, there were really only four.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting, though, because I think a lot of people listening would assume that it gets easier for you, especially mid-career, like we were just discussing. Obviously, you want to push, but it still feels very hard, and you feel very driven. It's like a compulsion.
Right. So this is the point of the podcast where if you're a budding chef, you might want to change the channel. No, it's relentlessly demanding the way we do it, mm-hmm. the way we do it. I know there's other, well, listen, honestly, I don't think there's any other way to do it. You have to be committed to it or be around people that are committed to it. And you always have to push the envelope a little bit somehow.
Mm-hmm.
It's an all in proposition. You just have to try to figure out how to balance it, which is not easy.
Okay. I have the ability to time travel. I have the ability to conscript your chef friends to make something for you. I also have a really magical picnic basket that can help break you out of jail before you have to walk the executioner's walk for that last meal. What's going to be in the picnic basket?
You know how many times I've answered this question?
That's the reason I have on the show.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's a good question. And yesterday I was speaking to one of our guests about hamburgers that I had in France when I was there in the late 90s, early 2000s, and had no money, and I was eating burgers out of these food trucks, and I was blown away that they all had French fries on them. And, I mean, that's as good of a bite as you can get. But having coming back from Italy for 3 weeks on my honeymoon, we had a great many of pizzas and pastas. You know, at the end of the day, the last meal is probably coming from one pot, and it probably is something that's cooked with soul and love, and I can eat with gusto. It certainly isn't overly presented, and it certainly is eaten with the people that I love.
Love it. Yeah. Love it. Well, if people want to learn more about Mike Lotta and The Ordinary and The Fig, you can go and Fig, not The Fig, but it should be called The Fig. You can go to thesouthernfork.com. I'm going to have links there as well as images so you can see the person behind the voice. If you like what you hear, you know the drill. There's a lot of different stories from different people in the Southern culinary landscape in the archives. So dive in. The easiest way to remember to do that is to subscribe. And of course, you're going to love it so much that you're going to tell someone else, which is kind of the point. So I can keep doing this for a job. Yes, it is some kind of weird job that I have. But thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. That was fun.
Hello, and welcome to Talking With My Mouthful. It's finally after Halloween. I ate a lot of tortilla chips and salsa, which frankly is, to me, better than candy. Although I ate candy too. And that means that it's time to start thinking about gift giving. And I just want to mention quickly, I do have a link on the website, thesouthernfork.com, for books from the show. And if you have liked one of the interviews, you can just go to books from the show on the Southern Fork website, click on one of those links, and it will take you directly to Amazon if that's the place that you want to purchase. And every one of those books has been featured on the show. I'm a big fan of cookbooks, and I think most people who cook are. There's just always one that you don't have that you'd like to have. So go and check out that tab. Go ahead and click on that. Get organized for the season. Maybe you need a cookbook to cook out of. So anyway, check it out, and I will talk with you next time.
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations, but in the meantime, I have one question. Are you gonna eat all that?